Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to Innergex Renewable Energy's 2020 fourth quarter and year-end results conference call and webcast. Bienvenue à la conférence téléphonique et à la web diffusion des résultats du quatrième trimestre et de l'exercice 2020 d'Innergex Énergie Renouvelable. At this time, all participants on the phone and internet are in listen-only mode. Following the presentation, we will conduct a question and answer session for analysts and institutional investors, and instructions will be provided at that time for you to queue up for questions. If anyone has any difficulties hearing the conference, please press star followed by zero for operator assistance at any time. I would like to remind everyone that the conference call is being recorded. I'll now turn the conference over to Karine Vachon, Senior Director, Communications. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. I'd like to specify that this conference will be held in English. Members of the media are invited to ask their questions by phone after this call. A presentation supporting today's discussion is available as we speak on the homepage of our website at www.innergex.com. This call contains forward-looking statements within the meaning of applicable securities laws. Although the corporation believes that the expectations and assumptions on which forward-looking statements are based are reasonable under the current circumstances, listeners are cautioned not to rely unduly on these forward-looking statements, as no assurance can be given that it will prove to be correct. Forward-looking information contained herein is made as at the date of this call, and the corporation does not undertake any obligation to update or revise any forward-looking information, whether as a result of events or circumstances occurring after the date hereof, unless so required by law. During this call, we will refer to financial measures that are not recognized according to International Financial Reporting Standards. Please refer to the non-IFRS measures section of the MD&E for more information. Our speakers today will be Mr. Jean-François Anneau, Chief Financial Officer, who will present Q4 and year-end results, and Mr. Michel Letellier, President and Chief Executive Officer, who will review our operational highlights. And I'll turn over the conference to Mr. Noe.
Thank you, Karine. Hello, everyone. I am pleased to report strong financial results. The growth we posted in 2020 over last year is mainly attributable to the commissioning of the Phoebe Solar and the Fort City Wind facilities in late 2019, and the contribution of the Salvador and Montanair acquisitions completed in May and July 2020. Production and revenues from the year were up 24% and 10% respectively compared to the same period last year. Adjusted EBITDA was up by 3%, while adjusted EBITDA proportionate was up by 8%. Before going further, I would like to stress that we are reporting on a continued operations basis, which excludes HS Orca from the 2019 results. On page 8, we will comment on the 3-month period results, while the remaining of the presentation comments will be made on the full year results. For the 3-month period ended December 31st, 2020, adjusted EBITDA increased by 14% compared to the same period last year. This increase was mainly attributable to a higher contribution from the hydro facilities in British Columbia and Quebec and to the Montanair and Salvador acquisitions completed in 2020. These items were partly offset by lower revenues from the Ford City due to an unfavorable net selling price and higher operational expenses, and a lower contribution from the France wind facilities. The joint ventures and associates contributed $15.5 million to the adjusted EBITDA proportionate, compared with a contribution of $20.1 million in the same quarter last year. This decrease was mainly due to a lower contribution from the Shannon and Flattop facilities, mostly due to unfavorable net selling prices, partly offset by higher contribution from Jimmy Creek and Toba Montrose facilities. In addition, the proportionate PTCs, production tax credit, increased from $17.8 million to $19.6 million due to the higher production from the wind farms located in the United States. Overall, adjusted EBITDA proportionate increased by 8% compared to the same period last year. On page 9, for the year-end December 31st, 2020, hydroelectric power generation segment generated $173.9 million in adjusted EBITDA, representing a 2% increase compared to the same period last year, mainly due to a higher contribution from the facilities in British Columbia, despite the curtailment imposed by BC Hydro for 5 facilities. Operational expenses in British Columbia were higher compared to last year due to a favorable settlement of the water rights claim in 2019. Wind power generation segment generated $263.9 million in adjusted EBITDA, representing a 4% increase compared to the same period last year. This increase was mainly attributable to the Montanair acquisition completed earlier in the year, the commissioning of the Fort City wind farm in late 2019, and higher revenues from most facilities in France. These items were partly offset by a lower contribution from the Quebec facilities and temporary shutdowns and production restrictions at some facilities in France. Solar power generation segment generated $39.2 million in adjusted EBITDA, representing a 26% increase compared to last year, due mainly to the commissioning of the Phoebe Solar facility in late 2019 and to the Salvador acquisition completed earlier in 2020. On page 10, the 8% increase in adjusted EBITDA proportionate in 2020 is mainly due to the production tax credit generated by the Fort City wind farm following its commissioning and higher revenues at the Toba Montrose and Doki facilities. These items were partly offset by a lower contribution from the U.S. wind facilities, explained by lower revenue from unfavorable net selling prices, a lower contribution from the facilities in Chile, as well as by a lower contribution from the Jimmy Creek facility, mostly due to the curtailment imposed by BC Hydro. Continuing on page 11, the $122.2 million increase in long-term debt is related to construction activities at Hillcrest and Griffin Trail, and to the long-term loans and borrowings assumed in the Montanair acquisition. This increase was partly offset by the corporate revolving credit facility repayment made following Hydro-Québec private placement, net of the amounts used toward the respective purchase price of Montanair and Salvador acquisitions. On page 12, changes in the total assets stem mainly from the increase in property, plant, and equipment related to Salvador and Montanair acquisitions, the increase derived from the construction activities related to Hillcrest, the Griffin Trail projects, and the increase in investment tax credit recoverable relating to Hillcrest construction costs. These increases were partly offset by $228.5 million in depreciation and amortization, and a $65.1 million decrease in investment in joint ventures and associates due to distribution received and an impairment charge on the investment in Energia Lima. Changes in total liabilities stem mainly from the increase in long-term debt and the increase in derivative financial instruments due to a general decrease in interest rate curves. The change in shareholder equity is explained by the private placement of $661 million to Hydro-Québec and an increase in non-controlling interest stemming from the Mountaineer acquisitions. These items were partly offset by dividend declared on common and preferred shares. As shown on page 13, the free cash flow remained constant on a trailing 12-month basis. The factors that has impacted the free cash flow are the free cash flow contribution of recently acquired commissioned projects, the higher contribution from Innergex hydro facilities in British Columbia, and lower interest payment on the corporate revolving facilities concurrent with the Hydro-Québec private placement. These favorable items were partly offset by the BC Hydro imposed curtailment, the sale of Innergex ownership interest in HSRK in May 2019, a lower contribution from the Québec wind facilities, the higher general and administrative expenses to support the corporation growth. Free cash flow was also negatively impacted by an increase in debt principal repayments and by the recovery of maintenance capital expenditures and prospective project expenses following the sale of HSRK in 2019. For the trailing 12 months ended December 31st, 2020, the payout ratio amounted to 135% of free cash flow, compared with 102% for the corresponding period last year. When normalizing its free cash flow and payout ratio with the non-recurring curtailment imposed by BC Hydro and the decrease in corporate revolving facility interest payment, combined with the increase in the quarterly dividend, Innergex estimates its payout ratio to be at 109%. Also, the Board of Directors has decided to maintain the annual dividend at 72 cents per common share for 2021 in light of the foreseeable growth plan, both in terms of acquisition and greenfield development. Before I conclude, let me update you on the Texas situation, on which we recently issued a press release. At the time of the press release, we estimated the financial impact of the recent weather events to be, on a consolidated basis, between $45 million to $60 million Canadian dollars. This estimate was based on the publicly available information as at February 17th. Innergex now estimates that the financial impact of the weather events during the storm that persisted until February 20th has reached, on a consolidated basis, approximately 80 million Canadian dollars, mainly due to the unfavorable impact from the realized loss on the power edges on Flattop, Phoebe, and Shannon sites. This financial estimate could still change as additional information becomes available. Force majeure and other mitigating possibilities are being evaluated. On that note, I will give the floor to Michelle for the operational review of the past year. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean-François, and good morning, everybody. I think that we have to cover a little bit of this Texas situation before going to the review of the year and a little bit of a forecast for next year. It's very unfortunate that we had to live through this crisis. It's a financial crisis, but it's also a human crisis. A lot of Texan resident had gone through a really bad time last week. I'd just like to also say thanks to our dedicated employees that gone through this crisis, even though they were facing some problem at home, and they went on site. It's true also for the Vestas and the GE guy that helped maintain our facility. So it was not an easy situation. I would stress that it was quite extreme in terms of temperature and also duration. And that has led the PUC to arbitrarily come up with a ceiling or floor price of electricity for quite a long period of time. And as you all read, it's standard for a period of a few days at $9,000 per kilowatt hour, which is extreme. One could say and look back and say, well, it could have been foreseeable that these things could have happened. It's true. But when you put all these stats together, it was very, very difficult to forecast that that type of magnitude, both in terms of weather event and also on pricing and duration. Over and above that, as you you've seen our press release and probably read about it in the press, the extreme weather had brought and started with freezing rain that unfortunately has froze up our plant in Flat Top, and the crews were trying to come up with a solution, but unfortunately the weather persisted, and also all the road access were very, very difficult and icy, so hand spray being big trucks and supply to come to sites. So it was a little bit also a perfect storm in the sense that unfortunately our other sites were available. We have Shannon and we also have Phoebe and Ford. They were available to produce. But somehow throughout that crisis, we've seen lower wind regime and overcast situation and some snow also that has reduced the capacity of solar plant to produce and wind, of course, to produce. So all that was very, I would say, come up with this notion of being caught in the perfect storm. Are we happy with this? No. But we had already initiated a new strategy in our investment in United States. If you remember, we were talking about Griffin Trail, a very different approach where we have secured the minimum revenue for the project to satisfy the tax equity, because one has to understand that all these power hedges were put in place in Texas in lieu of securing the tax equity financing for the PTC and the ITC in this market. So I would say that we wanted to get out of these power hedges. It was not necessarily easy. We were in the midst of talking to some of our tax equity partner at the time. But we definitely wanted to have a different structure in Griffin Trail, and we did. We did also a different approach with Ford, which worked very well. We have a PPA based on as produced electricity for Ford on 300 megawatt out of 350, and we kept 50 megawatt of exposure to merchant. And actually, Ford did very, very, very well in the last, you know, through that crisis. And if Griffin Trail would have been built and in service, Griffin Trail would have done a fantastic financial result during that that period of time. So bear with us. We want to have a different approach for Texas, and we did, and we had already initiated this new strategy. We want also to invest differently in the United States, and we've shown through Hillcrest development that 200 megawatt in Ohio that we're going to talk about in terms of construction. We also made an acquisition, Mountain Air, that diversified our footprint in the United States, and those projects are fully contracted. So we just want to make sure that you guys understand that we're not happy with what happened. We want to take this as a good lesson learned and try to find ways also to improve going forward. There might be some possibility of reducing this potential liability, as Jean-François said. I think that the oil industry in Texas is now sitting down and looking back at what happened and are hopefully coming up with new rules that would enable that market to be, I would say, more stable. I know that ERCOT and PUC and the governor and probably also on the federal level, they'll all sit down. This is going to generate a lot of negotiation, a lot of new IDs, and I'm hoping that at the end of the day, this crisis will change Texas to be a better place to invest and to take advantage of the great resources that the state has in terms of renewable energy. So that being said, I'll be available also to answer some questions at the end. But just want to make sure also that we wanted to say that we're not taking this as a small it's not a small hit, but it's definitely something that is out there in the sense that we knew that these contracts were not perfect, and we certainly had a different strategy, and I'm hoping that you guys are going to focus on this. In terms of corporate development at this time of the year, we always go back to look at to do a little bit of a look back on what we have done during the year, and I'm pleased to report that 2020 was a very busy year. Just to remember together on page 16 that we welcome Hydro-Québec as a shareholder and also as a joint venture potential partner to develop renewable project together. So we're quite happy, and on that aspect we have start to work with the team of Hydro-Québec, but COVID-19 had slowed down a little bit the effort that we were able to put together, but definitely this alliance is something that we want to mature and take advantage of. We also did two acquisitions. We've done an acquisition in Chile called Salvador. It's a solar plant that is doing just great. And also we bought 6 wind farms in Idaho, the project called Mountaineer, if you remember. So these are also part of the strategy to diversify our footprint in the United States. And also those two acquisitions, if you remember, were made on the basis of making sure that it's helping the corporation to build up its cash-on-cash short-term position to improve actually our ability to help reduce our payout ratio. So we've said that M&A will be a tool in our toolbox to improve on this and to create value for our shareholders. And those two acquisitions are two good examples of what we intend to do with M&A. So on page 17, also pleased to report that we've been busy in construction activities in 2020. We were hoping to have Hillcrest finished by December, but the COVID and the temperature, I must say the temperature in Ohio was quite rainy throughout the years, and that had created a little bit of issue for our contractor to install the panel. But all in all, I'm very hopeful that by beginning of April, we should be all finished. We're producing electricity as we speak. It's just a matter of finalizing all the connection and testing all the system. So pretty hopeful that by the beginning of April, things will be in full production. Inuvik project in the north of Quebec has been advanced quite well. If you remember, we were afraid because of the pandemic we would not be able to start construction, and at the end of the day we were able to establish a good system where our employees were safe and also the local residents were safe, and we did quite a bit of advancement in Inuvik. Very happy to look back at what happened during the year, and we're in a position to start the construction as soon as springs come back. The small project in France called Yon, it's not a big project, but like we said, it's our first project to be fully permitted and built by Innergex team in France. It's just a matter of days to be fully interconnected with RTE in France. So everything went very well. Very happy to have our first in-house project to be developed and built in France. And a little bit of the surprise of last year was the Griffin Trail project I just mentioned in Texas. This is very different from a power hedge. We are exposed to the merchant pricing over there, but we don't have any exposure to cover our production in Texas. So this is, in a way, a good achievement in the sense that we have convinced the tax equity provider to have this new structure to benefit to benefit for us and not being forced into power hedge. As we mentioned, this is something that we will not do in the future. And this approach of Griffin Trail, we would like to perhaps have exposure to some corporate PPA in Texas, just as Ford. So this is something that our team is going to work also to have a portion being PPA-based, but as produced, so that we don't want to have this problem of being short of electricity to service those PPA. But things are going very well in Griffin Trail in terms of construction. We have used the same team as we've done in Ford, and actually I'm pretty pretty enthusiastic on how fast these guys are doing. We have to this date all the foundation and all the major civil infrastructure are done. We have about 20 turbine already erected, and if things are going well in terms of weather, we're putting almost two turbines per day, so we need another 40, 45 days, perhaps, of good weather to finalize these erection of the turbines. On page 18, development activities have been also on the forefront of the 2020. Remember that we have four projects in Hawaii that we are working hard to get the permits and start construction on two of them. So this is something that is very important for us because, as you know, this is coupling solar and batteries, and in a market where the local utility is concerned and wants to develop some good technical aspect to have this wind and solar be introduced. So we're learning a lot, and I think that these experience or these project will help us replicate these type of project around our market. I think solar and battery are the way to go in many markets to develop renewable energy and to be able to supply capacity through the evening. We also have made a good advancement in the Project Tonnerre, which is only a battery, and this is also a good first commercial transaction with Evlo, which is the subsidiary of Hydro-Québec. Evlo is producing and selling a very good battery. We're proud to be the first customer of Hydro-Québec in this, and we love to be able to deploy more battery storage initiative together with Evlo and potentially some other supplier. But we like to develop this relationship with Hydro-Québec, where they have a great expertise on how to manage grid. So we're very hopeful that this first project will bring many more in the future. And in terms of Chile, we have continued developing Frontera, and as you know, I spoke about San Carlos water rights that we own just upstream Frontera. San Carlos is also advancing in terms of permitting. With the COVID, everything has slowed down a little bit in Chile, but we're developing, like I said, some other leads in Chile. Also, some solar project that we're looking, some thermal solar project. Also, we're answering some RFP from a copper mine in Chile. And so very, very still positive on the future output of Chile. This year on page 19, we're giving you, and we're going to report on this on a quarterly basis, is the prospective project. We're trying to give you a little bit more color on how advanced these projects are. I think that in the past, they were lumped into one big category, but we think that bringing you a little bit more color on how advanced these projects are through three categories going to give you a little bit more perspective on how successful we're advancing these projects, and I'm pretty happy on the advancement we did in 2020. You're seeing that we have advanced solar. You know that we want to work in the United States in deploying our solar panel that are basically grandfathering or pre-qualifying some up to about 600 megawatt of solar project in the state with full ITC, and very happy to have 200 megawatt, but you're seeing also on mid-stage that we have another 370 megawatt. So working hard on that aspect, and working also to diversify through PGM, Pennsylvania, Ohio, west of northwest of the United States. It's also a target for these type of projects. We're developing wind as well. We have a portfolio in the U.S. That is very promising as well. So going forward, you will hear us on every quarter giving you some update like this. Want to make sure that also France is developing well in this. We are advancing France. It's an important market for us. It's not a big project, but those projects have usually good economics. So also putting a lot of effort in France. On page 20, we just want to give you a little bit of guidelines for next year, 2021. We'd love to be able to increase our production by about 15%, revenue by 12, adjusted EBITDA by 12, and also adjusted EBITDA proportionate by about 12%. So I think we're going into the right direction there. Of course, we want to improve also on the cash on cash or the cash flow generation in 2021. Same strategy here. We want to make sure that we are developing our own project and use M&A as a tool to rebalance the cash on cash. You've seen what we've done last year in Montaner in Salvador. So all the team, M&A team, are focused to deliver this again in 2021. If we go to page 21, we just want to give you a little bit of what we forecast for the 2025 strategic plan timeline. Love to be able, as we said in the past, to provide a 10% adjusted EBITDA. But what we are focusing more and giving you more guidance now is to also bring an increase of about 12% on free cash flow per share by 2025. So that's a commitment that the corporation has. Yes, we want to grow the EBITDA, but we also want to grow the cash flow per share to improve our payout ratio. And as I mentioned, M&A will play a role with this, but also our own development pipeline project that we are developing. So on this, I think that we will be opening the floor, and I thank you, and Jean-François and myself are available.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question, please press the pound key. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question will come from Rupert Merer from National Bank. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
If we can start with Texas. So outside of the benefit of Griffin Trail, which will diversify your contracts, what can you do to reduce the risk of having a similar outcome in the future? Have you looked at adding de-icing technology and maybe talk about what that would cost or what your opportunities are to make changes to your hedge strategy?
Well, that's a good point, Rupert. I think that Texas now tax equity are going to be also a partner also in trying a solution. In the past, they were acting more as a lender, sort of speak. But with this happening, of course, the power hedge provider have now come up as potential lender or creditor in these things. So suddenly, tax equity are now an equity partner. They were always an equity partner, but they were kind of a preferred equity partner, almost like a lender. They were acting more like a lender. And so I think that they will be part also of the solution. In the past, we were trying to unwind these things and then find a financial solution to unwind these things. And they were very, very reluctant to engage. We were trying to reduce the exposure in Shannon for the last year or so. And it's always difficult, always complicated to get their attention on these things. So now that they're part of the solution and they're basically sitting on the same side of the table for than us, I think we will be in a position to unwind some of these power edges, either by reducing them completely or going a little bit like Ford or Griffin Trail and having them the time to renegotiate perhaps some corporate PPA or different approach. But the icing stuff and technology, you know, if we go back to flat top, it's true that if flat top would have been in a better position to produce, we would have incurred a lot less losses because we would have been producing throughout this period. But the problem is this $9,000 ceilings that was introduced, and I think that this is something that will have to change in Texas going forward. Of course, like I said, I think we will be in a position or trying to be in a position to get rid of these liability, these power hedges, get out of these position. But nonetheless, that wouldn't solve the problem of Texas per se. I think that this is a good time to reflect on the market rules. And perhaps it's been a while that Texas was entertaining some discussion around capacity payment. As you may all know, Texas doesn't have any capacity payment. They rely on having this big volatility on energy pricing to entice investor to invest in Texas. But that has those limits. You know, at one point, what is $9,000 going to do to induce people to try to produce when you're frozen, when the line, the gas line is frozen, when the pipe, water pipe are frozen? What else can you do? I mean, $9,000 is not helping anybody. It's just creating chaos. And I think that people will realize that. I also think that they might reconsider being interconnected to the rest of the country. They only have a few interconnection to the rest of the state, the neighboring states. So all these, I think, will come up, and there will be a lot of discussion. So, yes, we could definitely look into perhaps look into what we could do in our own facility to improve our ability to produce with cold weather. But, you know, even in Canada, a lot of our wind farms are frozen up in a recurrent occasion in Canada. It's just that we are building these downtime in our long-term forecast. and that's it. It's just that when you're not producing, it's sad, but you're not losing. You don't have to cover yourself with very, very high pricing. And this is what happened in Texas. This is the main reason why we had suffered these losses, is the fact that the price went through the roof at $9,000 per kilowatt.
Okay, thank you. And what do your contracts say about force majeure, and what does that process look like from here?
Well, we will be in litigation, Rupert, so I will not comment on this that much. I'm just saying that I think that a lot of players have retained litigator. We're in the process of evaluating all our position and how to react. We're in a position where our settlement date are on a monthly basis, so we have a few weeks before we have to make our position clearer. We have issued force majeure to our hedge provider, and I think that some other folks have only 5 days to settle, and they are right now in the middle of some discussion. So this is going to be a very dynamic situation in the sense that a lot of players are going to be in this. What I can say is this: what we have provided is the maximum liability that we have, and one has to remember also that we own 100% of Phoebe, we own 100% of Ford, but we only own 50% of Flattop and 50% of Shannon, and those are non-recourse to Innergex. So there's no way that this can filter and increase the financial liability to Innergex whatsoever, more than its equity portion in Shannon and Flattop.
Okay, great. I'll get back in the queue. Thank you.
Thank you, Rupert.
Your next question comes from David Quezada from Raymond James. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks. Morning, guys. Just a quick question, a follow-up here on Texas. Michelle, I think you just described the $80 million. Maybe I should just confirm this with you, that it was $80 million, but I think you also mentioned that there might be some movement in that number. Would that kind of suggest that you think the $80 million is the high end of what the exposure could be, and you expect any changes to that number would be to reduce it?
Well, yes. Well, right now, and I of course, we're in the middle of the crisis. There's litigation going all over the place. There's politicians sitting down with ERCOT, PUC. But what we're hearing is that a lot of stakeholders are questioning this $9,000, and also the time that $9,000 were effectively enforced. So anything that come out of those discussions that would reduce that $9,000, or the numbers of hour that $9,000 were input, would be directly proportionate. You know, if you would bring the that ceiling to three or four, then suddenly our exposure would be limited to something around 30-ish million dollars. So what we want is be very transparent in this, and some of you might have been surprised that $80 million that $80 million stand versus the ceiling, well, the range we had provided. But bear with us, we were in the middle of the crisis. We wanted to give you some guidance early on that crisis, and we were trying to forecast what would be happening further during the week, and we were surprised by Thursday losses that we had incurred. There were very little sun, and the forecast had forecast a little bit more sun, and the cold temperature continued, and unfortunately, a very weak wind happened in the night of Friday to Thursday. and that increased the losses versus our call on Wednesday. So yes, I think that the 80 is the maximum exposure that we have, and again, it's a potential liability. We haven't settled, we haven't sent any cash yet to the third party. So like I said, it's a little bit early. Everybody are scramblings with lawyers and arguments and meetings and stuff like that. So I think that we'll know in the next few days if PUC and ERCOT are revisiting the that ceiling pricing. And if they do, I guess that we'll issue perhaps, and we'll keep the market in line with those news.
That's great, caller. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's certainly a very dynamic situation. And then maybe just one related question, just with respect to your 2021 outlook and the 12% year-over-year EBITDA target. I guess that you'll probably wait until things settle out with the little litigation and the force majeure before you look to, I guess, potentially revise that number.
Yes, I agree. And this was normalized without that settlement. So yes, we'll give you more color as this situation unfolds.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that. I'll get back in the queue.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Sean Stewart from TD Securities. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks. Good morning, and thank you for all the detail. Michelle, the U.S. is still 23% of your prospective capacity pipeline. And as you gravitate away from the hedge contract structure, I just your comments on appetite for more merchant exposure, I guess you prefer to set corporate PPAs where you have price certainty, but if more merchant exposure is a part of the plan, can you comment on a need to build out an energy marketing component to your company? Is that something that's a part of your thought process going forward?
That's a good point, Sean. We had, I don't know how much we can describe that in percentage, but we increased our team from zero to two expert in trading, but also
origination.
Thank you, Jean-François. So we want to be more out there. There's some new platform also that have been put in place where it's a little bit like an electronic dates between producer and corporate off-taker. That platform is actually pretty dynamic, and it's helping. It has already proved benefit from for us. We have initiated term sheet with some corporate off-taker for some project in the States. So this is a very interesting, I would say. I would add up also on this notion of merchant. We want to have some exposure to merchant, and depends on in which market. I think Texas was, a good example of not necessarily being forced to deliver capacity when you have a variable asset. And but Ford is probably what we are aiming to, having the majority of the output being under contract and having a little bit of a exposure so that you're not necessarily all in for a lower price of electricity, but so you can have access to those spikes. But talking about also Texas and perhaps you have seen some negative pricing in some area, and Texas is notorious in the northwest of Texas to see these things happening, and low price of electricity. But I think there's a game changer here is hydrogen. Green hydrogen will play a role in the demand and being able also to stabilize these volatile market, because electrolyzer can be switched on and off almost immediately, and that doesn't hurt the process at all. I think that just to give you a perspective, for some of you that knows those mats with hydrogen, but it takes between 50 and 55 kilowatt hour to produce a kilogram of green hydrogen. So put that 50 and put the $20 per megawatt hour or 2 cents per kilowatt hour, and then the variable cost in terms of energy to produce a green hydrogen, a kilogram of green hydrogen is about a dollar. So that gives you a little bit of a perspective that if prices are low in a region and then you have this ability to go and install electrolyzer and transfer that very low renewable energy into green hydrogen, this is going to act a little bit as a buffer and as a floor to see price of electricity going forward. So I'm getting more and more optimistic in the sense that this market will not be in a position to have very long and prolonged low price of electricity. There will be some arbitrage to be done. And these electrolyzers can be installed fairly quickly, and also they can be mobile. So if for some reason you have a 5 years, 10 years outcome in terms of area being weak in pricing, you could install these things. And then I think that eventually price of electrolyzer will go down. And so I don't think we will be seeing these type of market having very, very low price of electricity. They will be acting also as Texas. You know, these things can be stopped, so you can take advantage of very low electricity when it is available. And if there's a spike, you shut down this this electrolyzer, and then you flow through the electricity to the market, and then take advantage perhaps on high pricing. So I think that there will be a lot of outcome and potentially positive outcome in some area where you see these pricing today that are very low. Green hydrogen will make a revolution around these market in the future.
That's great detail. You actually answered my second question with the answer to the first. I'll turn it over. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Sean.
Your next question comes from Mark Jarvie from CIBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Just want a few more details around the Texas and potential losses. It sounds like the $80 million is net of any EBITDA gains from power grid or assets that could generate. Can you quantify at this point? Because the losses are below the line on EBITDA. What is the impact through EBITDA?
Mark, you're right. So we should see a pickup in our EBITDA, and then on realized losses on financial instruments on one side, and a loss of share of loss of joint ventures and associates for all the realized loss on Shannon and Flat Top. It's too early to guide you, but you will see quite a good pickup in adjusted EBITDA. We should see coming, and a big loss on power edges on financial instruments. So we have decided not to disclose, you know, the pro forma of Q1 in that fashion, but this will happen this way, Mark, exactly.
I think, guys, it's a little bit early, and that's why we're trying to give you the financial impact, but we're still negotiating. We're going to have a lot of discussion with our power hedges supplier, and also we're in tune with whatever the policy or adjustment in pricing that ERCOT might communicate in the days ahead. So bear with us. I think we're giving you the ultimate and maximum financial impact, and we're going to work hard in the next few weeks trying to mitigate this.
But the net impact on net earning will come to around $80 million.
Yeah.
So, and this is also excluding all of the potential reset on mark to market on any other. So it's will become from easy to more complex to analyze all this at this time. So Michel is right. So we
Okay, thanks for that detail. And then can you just, in terms of how you settle these losses, I know you kind of do it on a monthly basis, but in terms of where the cash comes from, I think that maybe some of these projects might have a reserve fund, and I'm just curious how much capital from Innergex, like from the corporate level, has to go in to cover these losses, and does that slow your willingness either to do M&A or take on new development projects until you have clarity on how much sort of corporate cash infusion you need to do to settle these losses?
Well, that's a good point, Mark. And as for each of the projects, they provide a tracking account, they call the bank. So, and this is settled monthly. So up to now, like Michel have said, nothing has been settled. So at the month end, we will receive the final invoices. So what we have on end is daily statement of account of the tracking account. So the $80 million is coming from those statements, but nothing has been settled for now. So the level of the tracking account never been disclosed for those three projects up to now. But let's say that the $80 million, if we needed to refund everything above the tracking account, which is around $15 million for two projects and $12 million maybe for Phoebe, so then maybe what you would have to disburse could be a bit lower than the $80 million, if you follow me. But this is the way it works at the project level. But as I said, we don't want to comment too precisely on this, given the current litigation that is ongoing.
But to Mark, in a way, a little bit crazy, but Ford made money. You know, Ford has more cash flow. If everything settled this way, it's very positive for Ford, which is very the one that has been hurt the most is of course Flat Top, because it hasn't produced for all that period. The pain is then a little bit more towards the Flat Top, where theoretically we'll have to sit down and see what we can do with the tax tax equity, yes, but the power edge provider.
And
but in no way will be exposed to more than this.
Yeah. And to answer your second question, very important, the revolver capacity is sufficient enough. Would come any cash payment following any discussion or litigation process. And no, it does not impair our ability to hit on opportunity on M&A option, not at all. Matter of fact, we have paid down the EMP loan as at January. We have option to refinance that portion. We have few options ahead of us. There's Griffin Trail equity that needs to be invested in the second to third quarter. But looking ahead in terms of availability on our revolver, we don't foresee any issue. And most of all, we are pursuing our M&A activities as strong as before. So does not impact at all our ability to hit on that.
Okay. And then the Griffin Trail sort of revenue projections have moved around. I assume it's on assumptions around the spot curve. But do you have a sense today as it stands? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of volatility in pricing on the short end of the forward curve. But what this might do to forwards and your you know, where you think power prices will trend in Texas over the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, I think that Mark, we gave the, when we did the financing of Griffin Trail, it's something around $4 million, if I recall, Jean-François, that we gave on an average for the next 5 years, a little bit over $4 million.
And it's unclear where this event, Mark or Michelle, could have an impact on future power price curves, or I think it's clearly understood that this is unprecedented and one-off. So,
well, I think, Mark, what we said is that we're pretty conservative in the curve we're using Wood Mackenzie without carbon, now with Biden, would it be? I would love to see a federal tax on carbon somehow, somewhere. That would help definitely these future power pricing. Also, we've been conservative. We think in the basis losses. You know that in Texas, you deliver on the node, and then sometimes you get paid on the hub pricing. So that is also playing in the assumption that we have put forward for Griffin Trail. Maybe an output also for these projects in Texas, not necessarily tomorrow, but I think that all the ERCOT and all the stakeholders that are now sitting down and looking at this past crisis and trying to find a better solution for the future, maybe they need a lot more investment in their interconnection and also on all the transmission capacity across Texas, and they may get some federal help in order to do this. So that might also improve the market, because Texas has been known to be volatile, but more interconnection and more possibility to export from Texas would probably reduce that volatility going forward. So I mentioned green hydrogen. You know that in Texas, even if they're not that green in the sense that they certainly have a lot of Republican people in Texas, which is all good, but they have also all kinds of infrastructure that are consuming a lot of hydrogen. And I think that the customer that buys these finished goods are starting to put more and more pressure on the whole process and reducing the carbon footprint of all that industrial output. And I think that if somehow some green hydrogen is available in Texas, and the south of Louisiana also have huge industrial refineries that are consuming a lot of hydrogen. So if somehow, somewhere, they are becoming a buyer of green energy in order to reduce their footprint, then suddenly I think that the electrolyzer will be installed in Texas quicker than we thought initially.
Understood. Lots of different factors at play there. Last question maybe for JF is the operation and maintenance expense, the hydro segment, higher in the quarter, higher year over year on the full year basis. Is there anything sort of one-off in the last year in the hydro segment that drove sort of about a 10% increase in the full year O&M cost?
Well, Michel can comment as well, but I see that, yes, this year was a bit of a catch-up, but we did less also capital expenditures in this year, so we went through more operational expense to support the project. What I foresee is maybe more capitalized expenditures in the months or quarter to come, so maybe this year was a bit of a catch-up in terms of O&M for the project in BC.
Yeah, mainly Upper Illouette and the HELP tax also was hoping that we were to have it reduced, and I think that next year will be good news on that front. We're working hard to reduce this exposure, but
don't forget that's a good point. So if you compare to 2019 was reduced by a gain that reduced operating expense by $3 million, I think, because we had the recovery of the litigation on the water tax.
Yep.
So don't compare it to 2019, but 2020 was a bit higher versus our budget as well. So.
Got it. Thanks for the time and the interest. Appreciate it.
Your next question comes from Andrew Kuski from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks. Good morning. I promise not to ask a question about Texas.
thank you.
maybe just focus a bit more broadly on on you know, your solar initiatives and the existing assets you have and then what's in the pipeline. Given the really regulatory permitting and construction of solar, do you see an opportunity to generate cash faster as you have more solar in your portfolio?
Well, definitely solar takes, especially in the United States, it's a little bit quicker to do. For some of you, you've seen Project Palomino came into the news in a few times in the last few weeks in the States. So, yes, we're very active on that project. It's a 200 megawatt project in Ohio. We're getting very advanced. We also have some very good discussion with off-taker. And I think that we're seeing in the States a lot more willingness from corporate off-taker to take on solar as well. Solar are being, once they're built and then fully commissioned and what have you, are fetching quite a bit of a premium, I think. But when we can develop them, we can certainly generate a decent cash-on-cash on these projects from our own greenfield project. So that's why we're quite enthusiastic about our pipeline in the U.S. On that basis. We've said quite a bit about it regarding the investment we've done about a year ago, a little bit more than a year in buying the equivalent of a little bit over 100 megawatt of solar panel. And this is all around this idea of pre-qualifying about 600 megawatt of solar project in the state. So working really, really diligently, and these projects have to be in service by 2023. So that gives you a little bit of a guidance where we're heading in that direction.
Okay, that's very helpful. And I guess my second question is for Jean-François, and it really comes down to just any increased flexibility you see associated with green financings and just the sustainability initiatives that are happening from virtually every bank globally, on whether it means you know, more favorable lines of credit, how you project finance, and could you quantify any you know, basis points that you're going to benefit from in the future?
Well, it's a large question. I mean, of course, we're always on the look to improve, and those green bonds are there and as a possibility. Right now, we're a bit tied up with our project debt structure for the next few years. It's difficult to really reshape at the moment those project debt, given the large makeup they have with some institutions. So we don't foresee that we can benefit so much in the next 2 to 3 years, unless, Michel, you see.
Well, it's a very good question, and we've been inquiring quite a bit, and of course, always open to receive some input from our friend the merchant bank and what have you, but we have not seen a big spread reduction just yet. But we are seeing a lot of demand. So it's just, I think, a matter of time when we would see a little bit of benefit or spread reduction for that green bond. I'm hopeful that this is going to start to become a big advantage for us. Anything that ESG, as we know, is becoming more attractive also. My concern is a little bit of what we've seen. You guys, you must have seen it, a little bit of a green washing. There's a lot of issue that are borderline greenish in my books. So I think that as the market mature, I think the market will be more disciplined, and the real green bond will become something sought after, and hopefully we'll see a benefit in the spread. So far, we have, like Jean-François have said, we have not been so aggressive because we have these structure. Although we have, if you remember, we have about 16 unencumbered asset that support the credit line at the OLCO. Some of those projects have now been offered a new PPA and could be theoretically a good target to take out as a portfolio for a green bond. So quite interesting, interested in figuring out if we can leverage this. But hopeful that going forward, this is definitely helping. And I'm very happy to see that all the investors, not all, but a lot of investors are putting more and more weight into the ESG criteria in their investment, and we've seen some index fund being created, some infrastructure fund based on ESG criteria being created. So quite hopeful that this pool of money, smart money, will help us being cost cap that would bring our cost of capital being very competitive to not only us. I think the renewable energy industry will see a lot of new fund being directed to them, and this is good. I mean, we have tremendous opportunity to grow and to replace the fossil fuel in the near future, and we'll need a lot of capital, and that capital has to be competitive for us to displace the fossil fuel. So I'm very hopeful that this is going to help, and also that fossil fuel will have a higher cost of capital and hence the total competitiveness of us will become more clear going forward.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your last question comes from Naji Baydoun from IA Capital Markets. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate it's early days in Texas, so maybe we can talk a bit more about the longer-term outlook. You put out pretty strong guidance for 2025. I'm just wondering if you can walk us through what's baked into your outlook in terms of organic growth, how quickly you can move projects forward in the development pipeline, and if you're factoring in any M&A in that outlook.
Yeah, M&A will play a role. We said that for the next few years, we'll use it as a tool to rebalance, because as you know, we're spending, you know, over $20 million in prospective expenses, and we think that if opportunities arise, we may be in a position to increase that a little bit. So in order to balance this, obviously, even if we're developing and we're successful in developing, just the permitting and building and putting in commercial operation takes a few years. So M&A is a tool that we're going to use. Now, we're going to be laser focused on our M&A. We want to create this as a balancing tool. We want to create value, but we want to create value also in our greenfield project. Just to give you an idea, we're set up to hopefully bring from our own greenfield project something around 300 to 400 megawatt of project per year. Now, megawatt is something that will be useful also to declare in the future, but you know, it will have to take also in consideration that we might have capacity batteries that are not necessarily megawatt-based but are generating cash flow and investment opportunities. So I think that if you think forward of something of a run rate between 300 and 400 megawatt of a greenfield project, and the rest would be balancing with M&A, I think that we have been set up in the last few years to do one or two M&A acquisition per year. This market is not easy. We, you know, in order to be successful in one or two acquisition per year, we're looking at something around 80. Where we on an average year, we would send a letter of intent without without being firm, probably around 80, 85. And then you're selected on, I would say 10, 15 processes, and you know, if you're successful in one on two, that's roughly the average. So it takes a lot of effort, but it's also is useful because you can select where you want to go, where you want to diversify with M&A. So I know that M&A can be perceived sometimes as dilutive to shareholders, but it depends on how we do it, and it depends also if it's a tool to help sustain also the payment of the dividend and also sustain our ability to continue our own greenfield development.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And just to follow up on that, I guess, you know, we're thinking about the 300 to 400 of greenfield development a year. I mean, so you're pretty confident on being able to build out most of the sort of prospects in your mid and advanced stage development pipeline. It's kind of what that implies, or do you think you'll also be looking to acquire additional development projects as you go along?
Well, it all depends if the premium that one has to pay for a development project is worth the return or the risk that we're taking, but you know, it goes pretty fast. You know, yes, we're confident in our pipeline. We're confident that, you know, Palomino will see the light of the day. And then we have a few more solar projects that are pretty advanced as well. Working in Chile, we have a few other leads in Chile. And in Canada, we were happy to see that Quebec, Hydro-Quebec, is now talking about future RFPs in Quebec. So there will be opportunity in France. Our intention is to have at least one or two projects per year coming out of these greenfield. So yes, we're confident that we are starting up. And mind you, that it's only, you know, been 3 years roughly that we have put a lot more effort in the greenfield development, and now we're spending, like I said, something around $20-ish million dollars on prospective expenses, and we have hired more people, we have more people on the ground, we have we're more diversified also in our presence in the United States. So no, I'm pretty confident that this numbers is achievable for us.
And just a related question, I guess, on your overall funding or financing plans to achieve these objectives, I guess similar to what you would have, how you would have structured your growth in the past, a combination of tax equity, debt, and financings?
Yes. Well, we'll see how tax equity evolve. Of course, as the sunset clause is slowing down, perhaps tax equity will become less of a driver in the future for the United States. But in the meantime, yes, it's interesting to take tax equity as we to take advantage of the PTC, of course. Yeah, we like to have a balance of project finance and tax equity, and of course, equity component is always a big portion of these financing or structure. But when debt is cheap, it's always interesting to take advantage of it.
Just one last question, if I can. I know it's been a year now, and I appreciate it's been more difficult with the pandemic, but just wondering if you can give us an update on the Hydro-Quebec Alliance, how that's going so far. You partner with them on one project now in France. Just any more color on what we should expect from that alliance going forward?
Well, like I said, I think storage is a big play. We want to take advantage of the great resources that Hydro-Quebec has, the great capacity to give us support on interconnection and studies of interconnection. Also, I'd love to be able to play a role with them in M&A. Our team has worked together on a few ones. But like I told you, I mentioned that the odds of, or the, you know, you need to look at many in order to be successful. So I wish ourselves and the joint venture with Hydro-Québec success for some M&A also in the year to come, and working hard on trying to deploy the storage investment opportunity. I think that this is becoming mainstream in all the market, and our intention is to be present and develop and take advantage of the synergy of the two companies. But you know, it takes a little bit of time, right? And the COVID, unfortunately, has not helped us in terms of being able to travel and meet. And so I think that it's just a matter of us starting to make the ball rolling, and things will hopefully you'll see some good news in the next few months on that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Lots of helpful details.
Thank you.
Mrs. Vachon, there are no further questions at this time.
Thank you very much, and thank you, everyone. We'll gather again in May for our next conference call.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may now disconnect your lines.